This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Last night, the president delivered his State of the Union address with two great challenges: to explain the threat from Iraq and to persuade Congress and the American people that his ideas will get the economy back on the right track. To some degree, the issues are linked. Jitters about the war, for example, affect oil prices. But detailed evidence against Iraq will have to wait another week. Secretary of State Colin Powell is now expected to make the case to the United Nations Security Council next Wednesday. However, the president did bring up important domestic issues, including the economy, health care, the environment, and homeland security. So what did you think about his proposals on tax cuts, the deficits, Medicare reform, the environment, and homeland security? What issues were not addressed? Our number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. And we've also invited some party leaders to give us their reaction to the State of the Union. Last night, Governor Gary Locke of Washington presented the Democratic response following the president's speech. He joins us now by phone from Washington, D.C. to elaborate on what he had to say. And, Governor, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Neil.
Both the Democratic pre-buttal from Senator Daschle and Congresswoman Pelosi and your response last night focused on the idea of the president's credibility gap, that there's a difference between the president's words and his actions. What did you mean by that?
Well, we're very concerned that the president is proposing a massive tax cut, almost $400 billion in tax relief for the very, very wealthy Americans. And at the same time, he says that we don't have any money to put into education. We don't have the money. He vetoed money for Homeland Security despite his earlier promises that the states and local governments and police and firefighters would be fully funded for costs that they've incurred. We don't have enough money, according to the president, to really offer a true economic stimulus package. For just a fraction of the money that he proposes to give to the very wealthy, we could put that money into building roads, repairing bridges, repairing schools, and that would employ hundreds of thousands of people all across the country. We could just take a portion of the money he wants to give to the very wealthy by way of eliminating the tax on dividends and put that into education, because he has not fully funded his commitment of leaving no child behind. And the list goes on and on. The Democrats actually have a very specific, detailed plan of getting people to work as soon as possible, providing assistance to local governments, cities, counties, and states that are laying off police and fire and cutting back on health care. We have a plan of tax incentives for businesses to invest and hire more people and to really move our economy along.
So your job last night was, in a way, not only to present a critique of what the president said, but to present the alternative. What would you do?
That's correct. And we believe that we need immediate economic stimulus to create as many jobs as possible for as many people in every part of the country as quickly as possible. At the same time, making sure that we have funds to save Social Security, that we're not going to have huge, huge deficits that will only raise interest rates. And if we raise interest rates, we're going to have actually fewer people able to get a mortgage, afford a mortgage for home ownership, which is part of the American dream, it will be a burden on our children for generations to come.
The president began with his domestic agenda, ideas to stimulate the economy. You disagree with him, but that's what he began with. Now, your state, Washington, is having a particularly difficult time with unemployment in particular. Did the president's speech provide any answers for you and your fellow governors?
Well, actually, what's happening in the state of Washington with high unemployment is really true in virtually every part of the nation. And some 45, 47 states have huge budget problems, are having to cut back on police and vital services, cutting back on education, or raising taxes. We need a national solution to the economic problems facing everybody. And that's why we've got to focus on an economic stimulus package that is immediate, that creates as many jobs as quickly as possible.
Our telephone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address, totn@npr.org. We're speaking now with Democrat Governor Gary Locke of Washington State. After our first break, we'll be joined by Republican Congressman Christopher Cox, but we want to get questions in for both of our guests. So let's go first to Jeffrey, who joins us on the line from Jacksonville, Florida.
Well, thanks for taking my call. I'm curious It seems to me that any tax cut, federal tax cut, will be nullified by state, county, and town tax increases. And I've seen it in my own case. The $600 that I got from George Bush last year was eaten up by a $1,200 real estate tax increase in Jacksonville on my property. Everybody... I'm not getting any money from Washington. What's the answer? I don't care if it's a federal tax cut proposed by the Democrats or the Republicans. A federal tax cut does not work as long as there are other jurisdictions that can impose their own tax that will nullify that tax cut.
Well, Jeffrey raises a very good point. And that's why we need a comprehensive national solution to create as many jobs as possible to put a jump start into our economy, because if under the president's proposal all we're going to do is give almost a $400 billion tax cut to the very wealthy and not help the states, not help local governments who are having to cut services, then they're going to have to raise their taxes, and that doesn't help the average working American or the retired person who's also facing high prescription drug costs. That's why we need a comprehensive solution to get our country going again that helps everybody, not just the wealthy. Because if it just helps the wealthy, it doesn't help the states and it doesn't help the cities that are in tough fiscal times, and they're just going to have to raise taxes.
And one other issue, that any tax cut will make the federal government a greater borrower, which will increase the interest rate, which will fire up the furnace of inflation.
That's another good point, because under the president's proposal to eliminate the income tax on dividends, it means that tax-exempt bonds that your cities and counties and schools and states issue to build hospitals, to build prisons, to build schools, will not be as attractive to the investment community, and therefore the local governments and states and counties will have to pay a higher interest rate, which means
Absolutely.
That the taxpayers of your communities will actually end up paying more than they otherwise would have to build those prisons, to build the schools, to expand your colleges and universities, or to build your roads.
Jeffrey?
It appears that it's a charade. I appreciate you giving me the time, but it really seems to me like it's a charade.
Well, Governor Locke, are you, thanks, Jeffrey, for the call, by the way, and Governor Locke, are you raising taxes in the state of Washington?
No, because our state, we have a very tough fiscal problem as well, but given our tax situation and given the very high unemployment, I've proposed no general tax increases, no sales tax increases, no property tax increases, and no general across-the-board business taxes, and we're having to make some very, very deep cuts in state programs to balance our budget. But there are many states with even Republican governors, Republican legislatures that face even deeper budget problems than the state of Washington, and many of those Republican governors are raising taxes, and that's exactly what Jeffrey's point is. People are having to pay more taxes and fees at the local level. At the same time, the president wants to give some $400 billion in tax relief for the very, very wealthy when he could be putting that money back into local governments so that local governments don't have to raise those taxes. And he can be putting some of that money into building roads, repairing schools, and that will put hundreds of thousands of people to work in every part of America. That's how to get our country moving again.
Our next caller is Benjamin, who's with us from San Francisco.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I thought George Bush did a great job. I'm just so sorry that the likes of Governor Locke and other Democrats are saying that these tax cuts are earmarked for the very wealthy. Number one, the wealthy pay the most taxes and have for the history of this country, so you give them credit for that. Thank God they make money so that they can generate revenue for the government. Number two, the tax cuts are for everybody, and everybody who gets their proportional amount of money, any more dollars that they can get on a given year or a given quarter, it will bless them individually and bless the economy overall. It's a risk any way you look at it. We've seen tax hikes for the past 25 years, and all we hear are still we're short of funds for infrastructure, for jails, for schools, all that stuff. So I don't buy this baloney that Democrats and Governor Locke say that these tax cuts are for the wealthy. It's just not true. All right, thanks.
Appreciate it.
Well, actually, according to even the president's own administration's figures, the elimination of the tax on dividend income will only produce maybe 100,000 jobs. And the top 1% of American taxpayers, people who earn over $400,000 a year, would get more tax relief under the president's proposal than the other 95% of American taxpayers combined. We're not opposed to tax cuts, but we believe that the tax cuts should go to everyday working people. These are people who are working working very, very hard, who are having a hard time putting food on the table. But if you give them more money in their pockets, they'll be able to spend it, and that will help small businesses in every part of the country, and that will prime the economy. We're not against tax cuts. In fact, the Democrats have also proposed tax cuts, but for everyday working people, making sure that everybody gets a tax cut, and not under the president's proposal, more than half of his entire tax stimulus package goes to the very wealthy by eliminating the tax on dividends.
Let's hear now from Greg, who's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Good afternoon, gentlemen. I just wanted to give a call and say that I was disappointed that neither President Bush nor the Democratic response addressed the question of corporate corruption. I tend to believe this is partly because of the huge corporate contributions that go into politicians' pockets, and unless we pursue third parties like the Green Party, we're not going to be able to see the kinds of reforms that will make a real difference, including campaign contribution changes.
Well, Governor Locke, why'd you skip that one?
Well, we only have about 10 minutes, and we actually went a little bit longer than what we had hoped for, and we just can't cover every subject that we would like to. But the Democrats have actually led the way in terms of the legislation in the Congress, in terms of corporate reform. The Democrats have been calling for a change in the head of the SEC for quite some time, and the president was very reluctant to make the change. But the Democrats have always been leading the charge in this issue. And I know that, for instance, in our state of Washington, our attorney general, along with many other attorneys general across America, are suing some of these companies for their mismanagement, because it's had an impact on the pension funds that we hold for retired teachers and police officers and firefighters. So this corporate malfeasance is of great concern to people all across America, and especially to the governors.
But Governor, it's difficult for us to... A large number of people don't vote, and I think part of the reason that a large number of people don't vote is because we hear promises, but we never get delivery. President Clinton was in office for 8 solid years. How many roads were repaired? How many bridges were built? These are things that you pointed out in your speech. It's just not happening. We can't trust you folks to come across when you make a promise. That's why so many people are turning to alternatives.
Well, and I can tell you that with the money that President Clinton gave us to reduce class sizes, we hired more teachers. We reduced class sizes. I can tell you that with the money that came from the federal government, we built roads, we repaired some of the most dangerous bridges and intersections, and we've been able to put thousands of people to work.
Greg, thanks very much. We just have a minute or so left with you, Governor, and we very much appreciate you giving us the time. But of the issues you didn't hear President Bush address last night, which was the most important to you?
Well, I was surprised and disappointed that the president spent so little time talking about how he plans to get people back to work and to create more jobs in our country. He spent just a little bit of time on economic policies, and focus most of that on calling for the end of taxation on dividend income from stocks. And I just don't believe that that's going to help put our country back to work. Many of members of the administration and those who used to serve in his administration, and many people in the financial communities, also say that that's not going to create many jobs.
Governor Locke, thanks so much for being with us. We know you're very busy today.
Thank you very much, Neil.
And have a good trip back home. We're talking about the President's State of the Union Address. When we come back from a break, we'll hear from Congressman Christopher Cox for the Republican take on the President's speech. What did you think of the President's domestic proposals? We're taking your calls at 800-989-TALK. That's 800-989-8255. You can also send us email. The address is totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking about the President's State of the Union address last night and whether his proposals will be moving the country in the right direction. What do you think? Give us a phone call, 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. And our email address is totn@npr.org. We just heard from Governor Gary Locke of the state of Washington, who gave us a Democratic take on the president's speech. Joining us now on the other side of the aisle is California Congressman Christopher Cox, chairman of the Select Committee on Homeland Security and chairman of the Policy Committee. He joins us from his office on Capitol Hill, and welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Good afternoon.
You heard what Governor Locke had to say. I wanted to give you a clean shot in response.
Well, I think to take it from the top, the president last night addressed a Congress that had his speech in advance, had a chance to read it and absorb it even before he gave his remarks, and on virtually every salient point that the president raised on the domestic side, growing the economy and creating jobs, strengthening and improving health care, promoting energy independence, improving the environment, and so on, and on the worldwide stage side, the president got standing ovations from both sides of the aisle. There's a certain amount of Coke versus Pepsi when you talk to Republicans and Democrats after the State of the Union. There's this competition for market share among voters, and so if you're Coke, then you got to say Pepsi's no good and vice versa. But the truth is that if you take a look at the national reaction to the president's speech, it was very well received, and for good reason, because I think he's focused on the main issues that affect the country right now. The Democratic response, and we had a good presentation of it just preceding, is in fact in general agreement with the president that what we need is economic growth and job creation. And with respect to Saddam Hussein, there isn't much disagreement that he's a horrible bad actor. He's a malicious, sadistic individual that we can't trust, and we're scared to death that he's got his hands on weapons. There's a little bit of disagreement about, you know, upon whom rests the burden of proof that disarmament is underway. I think the president made the point last night that, you know, we settled with this guy after the last war in 1991. He signed terms of surrender. He told us as a price for his continued freedom, so that the war wouldn't continue to Baghdad, that he would disarm. And the United Nations determined, as a result of that ceasefire, that he had already in his possession 25,000 liters of anthrax. And he hasn't told us and won't show us, even with inspectors back in country, what became of that. There's absolutely no evidence that he's destroyed it. Same thing with 38,000 liters of botulinum toxin. That was a UN determination that he had that, and nobody can tell us where it went, and on with the sarin, the mustard, the VX nerve agent. So the burden rests on Saddam Hussein to show that he no longer has these things. It does not rest upon the rest of the world, on the United Nations now, to conduct, as the president said, a scavenger hunt through the desert.
And so, again, we'll see much more on that next week when the Secretary of State addresses the Security Council. We have an email question for you, Congressman, from Marilyn in Washington, D.C. The president, she writes, said early in his speech he would not leave a mess for future presidents, but he did not explain how the astronomical debts he will leave at the end of his term will not be a mess for whomever follows.
Well, I think that's exactly what the president had in mind with that line. He's talking about fiscal responsibility, and he enjoined the Congress to do two things. First of all, enact a program of economic growth, because growing the economy is the way that you end deficits and bring back surpluses. And second, he told us we need some discipline on the spending side. People may not know it, because we've had Republican management in Congress, at least in the House, in recent years, and yet spending growth at the federal level last year was 7%. Now, the federal government's very, very big, around $2 trillion, and the 7% growth factor, when inflation is running at 2%, population growth's around 1%, and the economy grew last year at 3%, is unsustainable over the long term. The president enjoined us for discipline on both sides of that equation, but we've got to have economic growth. We could balance the budget in theory by raising taxes ever higher, but in the end there wouldn't be job creation, because we'd be taxing away the job creating capacity of this economy, and the only help wanted signs out would be federal agencies.
Let's go to a phone call, and Deborah's on the line with us from Ridgewood, New Jersey.
Yes, hello, how are you today?
Very well, thanks.
I enjoy a very comfortable living here in Ridgewood. My family earns in excess of $400,000, and I quite frankly feel that people like myself, who tend to read a little bit more than the average American and enjoy a comfortable living, I feel my intelligence was insulted, quite frankly. I feel that we are being pushed up against the wall to fear so that we could spend more on a military apparatus. When you compare our defense spending to services, defense largely outspends anything that any social service program could ever exhaust. So I think some of the economic stimuli that the president proposed, not that he proposed very much, it won't substantiate any type of relief as far as our economy is concerned. And I quite frankly, I feel as a Republican and as a wage earner that my intelligence was insulted last evening.
Congressman Cox?
Well, I would agree with the caller that there is a serious moral hazard here of reacting to the necessity of a war on terrorism with undisciplined spending on new anti-terrorism initiatives and on the military generally. In fact, if one reads the speech, it is available in plain text on the internet, and if one takes a look at the policy initiatives that President Bush is asking the Congress to enact, there is not a call for massive new spending. The whole purpose of the creation of the Department of Homeland Security, which my committee will oversee, was to consolidate the seemingly independent work of many agencies that share this responsibility. And the president was quite clear when he asked Congress to create this committee in the first instance. We expect not to spend more money, but to save money. And we're going to be looking for savings and efficiencies as we consolidate these agencies. On the other hand, my political opposites on the other side of the aisle are talking about spending more money, even as this department has been open only for a few days. And the mantra seems to be, you're not spending enough money, you've got to spend more. And I hear it over and over again, and I would agree with the caller.
Well, how is it that we are deployed in so many areas of the world today? It's frightening where our troops are presently are sitting. We're in Colombia. We're in various places of Africa. We're just so spread thinly, and I'm just very very concerned that this, quote, war on terrorism is so amorphous, and we have essentially rendered the UN obsolete with not working through that venue.
Deborah, to be honest, to be fair, the president has been working through the United Nations and is sending the Secretary of State to brief the Security Council and presumably the rest of us on the evidence next week.
Yes, I agree with that, and I appreciate the pause that the president is taking, but people within his earshot are advocating a unilateral decision about going to, quote, defend us. Afghanistan and the Taliban was, well, not Afghanistan, I beg your pardon, but the Taliban and al-Qaeda were the ones supposedly responsible for the atrocity committed in New York City. Mm-hmm. Now we're going to Iraq. He mentioned Iran last night, and that really threw me for a loop.
Okay.
Because I didn't know that Iran was now an issue. I remembered that he said last year
axis
that they were
of
part
evil,
of the
yes.
Axis of Evil. But, I mean, how many people can we go and do this preemptive thing with?
Okay, Deborah, thanks very much for the
Thank
call.
Thank you.
Congressman Cox, I'll give you, I know you have to leave, and I'll give you a chance to respond to that if you'd like, but I also know that you have other things scheduled.
Well, I'm happy to share as much time with you as you care to on the air. I think that the suspicions that the caller is manifesting are not unique to her. I think a lot of people around the country are worried that there's something going on in the name of Homeland Security that they should inherently mistrust, that we're going to lose our civil liberties and so on. In fact, to a certain extent, I share those biases. I want to make sure that as we conduct the war against terrorism, we do not in any way constrict the freedoms that we all enjoy, because that's what we're trying to protect here. Otherwise, we can just move to some other country. But I would disagree somewhat with the caller on this subject, that the United States is too far flung. The president last night committed us to a new course on a new continent. We are going to spend over the next 5 years $15 billion taxpayer dollars, including nearly $10 billion in new money, on an AIDS pandemic that is killing people in a modern plague, because we have the capacity to stop it. Dr. Frist, who's become the Senate Majority Leader, has been urging this course on the president for a long time. I think it's the right course. I'm proud that America is taking this course. But yes, I mean, this involves us in other people's lives in other countries rather expensively. I think, however, that the costs of tuning out these calamities around the planet will become manifest. These problems, these plagues, will revisit themselves on us in other ways, some of them predictable, some of them not. And we should act as the leader of the free world. I hope that the money that we invest in stemming the AIDS pandemic on the continent of Africa is, in fact, merely the American contribution, and that the rest of the world will follow suit here. But the United States has a leadership role to perform in this, as in security matters, both within and without organizations such as the United Nations.
Can you take one more call with us, sir?
Sure.
All right, let's hear from Celia, who's with us from Los Angeles.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, and I want to thank the Honorable Congressperson for staying on the line as well. My comment is specifically around the comments made last night about hydrogen fuel cell cars. And now I do want to commend the President for making the comment, and I think that it's a testament to the fact that there are real constituents out there, you know, environmentalists and otherwise, who he has to answer to. But I'm wondering, don't you just think that that was sort of throwing a bone out there? And I really feel that you know, if there was a real commitment to this, it would be more than to research, but it would actually be to something like what President Carter had done, which was really put the country on a path toward being very up to speed and ready to go on all alternative fuels, not reliant on foreign oil. And unfortunately then, you know, the Republican administrations that followed gutted all of those. Mm-hmm. But we were on a pathway really to avert this kind of war on terror. And I also think that what happened last night was really just another way to avoid the assertion, which I believe is true, that this is a war about oil. And so I'm interested to see what you would respond to that. And I want to make sure that you know that, you know, next Tuesday, people all around the country are going to be educating their neighbors peer-to-peer at gas stations all around the U.S. as part of a program put out by TargetOil.com to talk to people about this and to say, you know,
okay,
what?
Celia, we're running out of time, so I wanted to give Congressman Cox a chance to respond.
Well, I hope that in not too many years, these organizing efforts will be taking place not at gas stations but at hydrogen filling stations. That's what the President's initiative is aimed at, and I think the caller, albeit she's natively suspicious apparently of environmental proposals from the Bush administration, would actually substantively agree with the replacement of internal combustion engines with hydrogen fuel cells. And we now have within reach the opportunity to do just that. I am very, very hopeful that this can be accomplished. I have been working well in advance of the President's announcement last night with Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon on initiatives to pave the way for hydrogen filling stations, hydrogen fuel retail outlets where you can fill up along the road. This may be supplementing hydrogen that can be manufactured at home if we ever come to that kind of technology, because we've already got a commitment now from the automotive industry. They've invested billions of dollars on their own to build the cars, but this is going to be a chicken and egg problem. Nobody's going to want to buy the cars if you can't take a trip anywhere because you're going to run out of fuel on the way. Fuel cell technology, which is underway at the University of California in my district, which is going on all over the world right now, is so real that I am convinced it's going to happen. And while I don't want the federal government to put its thumb on the scale in favor of particular technologies, I do think what we can do is speed up this process, and I think the President's initiative on that is very far-reaching.
I apologize. Now we have to go, but thank you so much for your time.
Happy happy to join you.
Congressman Christopher Cox of California joined us from his office on Capitol Hill. And by the way, tomorrow on Talk of the Nation, a closer look both at the AIDS proposal and at the idea of hydrogen fuel cell cars. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Yesterday, we spoke with the Washington bureau chief of Deutschland Radio, Siegfried Buschluter, about German expectations of America's State of the Union. He's back with us today to give us a postmortem and joins us again from his office in McLean, Virginia. Good to have you back.
Hi, Neil. Nice to be back.
So what was the reaction to President Bush's speech last night in Germany? Did the people hear what they wanted to hear last night?
Well, as you remember yesterday, I told you what they want to hear from the president is whether he's made the decision to go to war with Iraq. And I think, yes, I'm pretty sure he's made up his mind to go to war with Iraq. I don't see any scenario, except for a coup or exile for Saddam Hussein, where war could be avoided. And then what my listeners wanted to hear last night was whether America would wait for another UN resolution, whether the administration would work for another resolution. Yes, from what the president said last night, I think they will be doing that, but they won't wait forever. The question is, how long will the administration wait? And then the third question we discussed yesterday, where I said my listeners would be interested in that, is whether America would go it alone and why now? And I think, yes, the president made it clear last night that America would act even without a clear UN mandate and why now. There, I think the Germans are still very skeptical, as I am. I don't see any imminent threat, and I don't see a convincing, let alone a compelling reason to go to war with Iraq now. And I think that's a majority opinion in Germany as well.
Does this put an awful lot of weight of expectation on the presentation by the Secretary of State next week at the UN?
I think it does, because I know from German politicians, they have been pressing the Bush administration to come forward with this kind of information, because everyone is waiting for a smoking gun, even though this is not required by the UN Resolution 1441. But everyone is waiting for that kind of evidence, and if the Secretary of State has got it, you know, they are waiting for it.
Siegfried Buschluter, we'll be checking in with you, I think, over the next weeks as this continues to develop. But thanks very much for your time today.
Thank you, Neil.
Siegfried Buschluter is the Washington bureau chief of Deutschland Radio, and he joined us on the line from his office in McLean, Virginia.